thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope you are well, safe and healthy, and that you are finding a way forward to manage the best you can during these times of challenges and opportunities, I would like to say. I'm hopeful that listening to this podcast will help you in a positive manner. On that note, and to increase the energy of our discussions even more, if that's possible, today we have two guests with us, Lars Meisinger and Alexander Lenz, both from Aquila Capital. Welcome, and thank you for being with us today. I'm very excited about today's episode, since we're covering the investment and the real asset solutions, slightly different from other episodes again, with some real experts and passionate individuals. And I must admit that I'm looking forward to listening to you, gentlemen, and learning a lot today, given that I must put my hand up and admit that, you know, this is definitely not one of my expertise areas. As an introduction, let me share a short bio for each of you for the benefit of our audience. Lars Meisinger is head of Aquila Capital's International Client Advisory and Corporate Development. Prior to joining Aquila Capital in 2016, Lars was responsible for strategic product development at UBS Asset Management. He previously served as Chief Operating Officer at BlackRock Alternative Investors for the EMEA region. His long professional experience includes 8 years in management roles at Man Group and senior positions at AXA Investment Managers in both London and Frankfurt. Lars holds a master's degree in economics from Maastricht University and a bachelor's degree from Johann Wolfgang Goethe University, Frankfurt, and he is a chartered alternative investment analyst. Alexander Lenz was recently appointed CEO Asia Pacific at Aquila Capital. He is based in Singapore and has worked in the renewable energy sector since 2007. Prior to joining Aquila Group in 2020, Alexander was the CEO of Conergy, where he focused on development and investment in solar PV assets, both utility scale and behind the meter C&I, across the Asia Pacific region. Previously, when Conergy was part of a global group, Alexander was the CEO and president of APAC, responsible for the group's business in Asia Pacific and the Middle East, with a focus on project development, turnkey EPC contracted, and on an O&M of utility scale solar PV assets in the region. And before moving to Asia, he was head of corporate development in Conergy's headquarters in Hamburg. Alexander was previously a consultant in the restructuring and corporate finance practice of Roland Berger Strategic Consultants in Berlin and in the management consulting practice of Deloitte in Dusseldorf. He holds a master's degree in economics from Maastricht University in the Netherlands. So as the listeners can imagine by now, we will be covering Europe, including UK and APAC today. Okay, that's out of the way now. Great CVs, guys. And I noticed you both went to Maastricht, right? Which I just by chance, right? You don't know from each other from all the way back then.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We actually met in Maastricht, so we've known each other for how many years now, Lars? 20 something, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. You see? So you know, for those, when we tell people, they know that actually the people that you meet at the Masters is very important. So there you go. You are a true example, I guess.
Yeah.
So as it is our tradition, our first question to all our guests is, what is sustainable and impact investing? So perhaps, I don't know, Lars, if you want to start.
Yeah, I mean, sustainable investing in for us is really related to the core of what we do. I mean, our business focuses on real assets or essential assets, renewable energy, real estate, timber and agriculture. And I think for the benefit of our discussion today, we will stay with energy. And for us, energy, renewable energy is one of the most sustainable resources for energy production. And therefore, we have a clear business focus on sustainability. Now, impact is taking that theme beyond, and actually, you have to assume that whilst ESG in today's conversation is omnipresent, I think we are moving the goalpost away from ESG steadily to impact in the future, where it's not only about compliance with environmental aspects, social and governance aspects, it is about how do you make sure that there is a benefit beyond the financial return for others, for the communities, and for society as a whole.
Excellent. And Alex?
Maybe to add on to what Lars said as the last sentence, I think this is something, if we're talking about impact, we can talk about impact that we create for our investors. We can also talk about impact that we create for the countries in which we're investing. And here, I think specifically, if you're talking about Asia Pacific, with a very diverse geographic landscape, many developing countries, especially in Southeast Asia. For me, it's always been very fascinating to see in the last 10 years how, for example, starting to invest and build solar power plant creates impact on the ground in local communities, for example, in very rural areas of the Philippines, where all of a sudden you create jobs, where all of a sudden you kind of train people, you bring completely new job types to a certain area where you generate electricity, which leads to the fact that there's an impact on the inequality that's existing there in these rural areas, etc. So this is something which is very tangible here in the region, and it's something which obviously makes this job and what we do very rewarding.
Very nice. Very nice. And we will talk about, you know, impact and some, you know, part of the measurement. So perhaps we can bring this up again and look at some of the specifics, you know, in terms of what you have seen. I think that's great. And also, you know, what you think is coming in the future. So if I just do a quick introduction to your company, again, for the benefit of the listeners, Aquila Group is a leading investment manager in real asset solutions. Its sustainable investment strategy focuses on investments in renewable energy, energy efficiency, infrastructure, residential real estate, green logistics, as well as timber and agriculture. It was founded in 2001 by Dieter Brentsch and Roman Roslenbroich as one of the first German alternative investment firms. Aquila Group currently manages 11.2 billion euros for institutional investors worldwide as of 31st of March 2020. And then I thought I'd just mention a couple of key numbers which are on your website, and I always would recommend people to go to your website, which is aquila-capital.de. But again, just for reference, for context, I like it. So it was established in 2001, over 11 billion AUM, 350 plus employees globally, 14 international locations, 6.5 gigawatts of energy, right? Which again, I tried to, you know, look for a reference. Which energy, so 1 gigawatt is about 750,000 homes. That's kind of what I picked up when I was trying to give an idea. So that's about 4.9 million kind of homes that you can provide energy to, although I know that may not be the way that you look at it. And then you have 13 terawatt hours as well that you produce, which again, for context, you know, the world total electricity final consumption in 2008 was over 22,000 terawatts again, so that people, I think, get an idea if I've never really looked at it before. You have been over a decade climate neutral, and you have 579 wind turbines in your portfolio, 113 solar PV parks in your portfolio, and 144 hydropower plants. So it's, I would say you have a lot and you produce a lot. Anything in particular that you want to tell me about Aquila and what you're doing? Perhaps, I don't know, Lars, you know, you've been in the company for a while and you've seen the development and you're working on that as well. And then perhaps Alex, you know, in terms of specific more to what you're doing in APAC.
Thank you, JP. And I think, look, we're immensely proud of the achievement so far, of course. I mean, we are ambitious going forward in terms of the development of our business. But as you said, I mean, being one of the very few independent investment management businesses in Germany and being now in operation for 20 years is, in my view, a very strong vindication of the vision that the two founders set out, Roman and Dieter, and they steered the company towards this focus now on real assets. And you spoke about our capacity under management and construction, and I think we have built a very significant portfolio of renewable energy production across Europe and in a diversified way among the three major sources of generation, solar PV and hydro. So that's, in our view, something we are very proud of. And certainly we also want to continue investing in Europe. You mentioned energy efficiency, where we have now started to developing businesses in the context of the wider energy transition and decarbonization of Europe. But also, as you might have followed us in the last 18 months, taking the business into a very deliberate direction to Asia, which is, I think, a very good point for us.
Yeah, thank you, Lars. Maybe if we talk about Asia, let's briefly look at the opportunity. So compared to Europe, Asia is a very heterogeneous geographical scope, basically. Many different countries, each country with own challenges, two main groups of countries, which is on the one hand, a group of developed countries around Taiwan, Korea, Japan, Australia, and then there's a group of developing nations in Southeast Asia. Basically, we're talking about different degrees of market life cycle. Some of these countries have had deployment of renewables already supported by the government or driven by supporting policies and regulations. Others are in their infant stage. Talking about potential, as you said right from the beginning, I'm an ex-consultant. I like to draw simple comparisons. One very simple but very tangible comparison is Southeast Asia. We're talking about 600 million people. Of these 600 million people, a very high fraction is not even connected to the grid nowadays. If you, for example, are thinking about countries like Indonesia, island archipelagos, etc. In these 600 million people, we've got a capacity of 12 gigawatt installed capacity of renewables. So round about double the capacity that Aquila holds in the whole region. Germany, compared to that, 80 million people and approximately 50 gigawatt of installed capacity. So here you see a massive mismatch between what can happen if a government is applying the right policies and regulation and making it easy or simple for renewables to compete, and what should happen basically in a region like Southeast Asia, where obviously the resource, which is sunlight, is much, much more abundant in rainy Germany. What we want to do here is we want to help accelerate the deployment of renewables in the region, enable our investors to come here and invest in the region. But first and foremost, also help to bridge the existing gap between what we call early development, which is mostly driven by local companies on the ground in the countries itself, and creating a bankable product, which an investable product, basically. And this is, you can only achieve if you bring on the one hand side transactional experience, but on the other hand, also the development and the technical experience with you to manage the risks to bring the project through the development phase. So I would say what we want to bring to the table is smart capital as opposed to passive capital that is abundantly existing, but doesn't really get to the point.
Excellent. And I like the smart capital point because, again, just to relate, and we had several conversations as well in the past, but you have these kind of entrepreneurial teams, right, that identify, develop, finance, manage, kind of conduct kind of all investments along the entire value chain, right, using this industry expertise and networks, right? So I don't know, Lars, maybe you can share again for the benefit of people, you know, kind of what the supply chain looks like and, you know, what you guys do kind of different and at the same time, kind of more perhaps intensively than other companies.
Thanks, JP. And let me just pick up on the point about entrepreneurialism, because I think that is really going back to the very DNA of the company. It was set up in October 2001, which is a very kind of defining sign, having the uncertainty around that time. Both founders still decided to go ahead. And that philosophy of conviction and taking risks, calculated risks, is an important aspect of what we do. I mean, we have a very industrial approach, as you rightly outlined. We are able to cover the entire development chain of projects and have created a very high degree of specialization amongst our teams. So we have, next to our investment teams who are originating, sourcing the transactions and executing them, we have a number of very highly specialized and skilled teams supporting them. That is already very important in the beginning with the dedicated asset management team specialized by technology. We have colleagues in the merchant market desk who are advising on the best offtake agreements for power, which is more relevant as we are moving away from the classical feed-in tariff systems. We have a own project finance group, and that level of specialization helps us to manage the complexity. When you introduce the company, I think, and also an important aspect is really kind of the endorsement of Europe as a whole. And that is best expressed through our office network, where we have really covered Europe from Oslo in the very north to the very tip with our offices in Lisbon and in Madrid. And so understanding that heterogeneity of Europe is an important aspect when you look at Asia, where Alex is now taking the lead. And entrepreneurialism means entering deliberately into new markets, seeing the potential, being perhaps also ahead of others, but also and being aware that this is taking you sometimes in a more uncharted territory. And I think we have now built that track record, that reputation, and also the processes around it that help us doing this over and over again. And with the help of colleagues like Alex, we are also now feeling that we are at the right step of building Asia for our clients.
Perfect. And on that point, congratulations again on the appointment, Alex. What an achievement, and again, wonderful, in terms of your career and what you have done, to be able to have this opportunity, right? And it is still your initial 100 days, right? So you are like completely fresh and going through that fun period, if we could call it that.
I'd say it's day 105 today, so I'm out of the 100.
Oh, is that right?
Out of the 100-day period, yes.
Perfect.
No fun anymore.
So anything that you can or that you would like to share in terms of, what your, and obviously, because of everything you have done already in the region and in the past, in terms of your plans and your vision, and then perhaps maybe to start with a bit of context again, what is perhaps the size of your business today? And, maybe where you, based on what you mentioned before, in terms of all the opportunities that are out there, what is you think the future looks like for you and Quila APAC?
Okay, sure. I guess the business as it stands today is obviously small business. It's a startup here in the region. We're just starting 105 days. We've put together a team of experienced senior people that have worked and lived in the region for quite a while. And the ambition is significant. You might know that we have attracted a shareholder in the group from Japan end of last year with Daiwa Energy and Infrastructure, part of Daiwa Securities. This is something which has led the founders to push more for also starting an Asia business. Mm-hmm. And maybe one step back to what I said earlier, the opportunity in Asia is significant. The opportunity, so for example, Bloomberg in Energy Finance thinks that the APEC region, including China and India, will attract around $4,530 billion, which is translates into 40% of the expected global investment amount between now and 2050, so in the next 3 decades. This shows where the magnitude of the opportunity, and the magnitude of the opportunity comes really from the fact that many of these countries face different challenges than developed countries. They face the challenge that basically the delta between supply and demand on the energy side widens because an outdated generation makes retires. Population is increasing, GDP per person is increasing, wealth is increasing. So people simply require more power, more electricity. So this gap needs to be plugged. It can be plugged by renewables because renewables are competitive or will be competitive in the very short term, especially here in this region. So this is basically where we want to help. I think I've seen in this region here a lot of European players come and go because it is simply not easy to kind of, first of all, get into that market, get into these markets. Second of all, build a business and scale because Asia is all about relationships. it's less transactional. So I've seen a lot of people trying to solve this chicken egg problem of hiring a few people, very limited, and trying to build pipeline and then disappear again after 2 or 3 years. And the Aquila approach is different. Coming back to your initial question about size of a team, we are currently 11, but this is quite a lot given that we are on day 105. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a massive investment of the company, again, creating impact or seeking to create impact in that region here. And the goals that we have in the coming years is to play a relevant role in this market here and accumulate a significant market share. I'm very reluctant to, I think, put up numbers at this stage. First and foremost, because it's early days. Second, because of Corona, because currently the market transparency outlook is a bit blurred. But I think if you look at the ambition or at the growth that the company has seen in Europe, we want to transpose this to Asia and achieve the same here.
William. And yeah, you mentioned the partnership with Daiwa, which, you know, is a substantial investment at the same time. And we may touch on that as well in terms of the scalability of the company and the industry in a later point. But maybe if I bring it back to, you know, a couple of comments that you both made, you know, in terms of the clients and the investors. So did I hear correctly before? Do you foresee that some of the investment for the region is going to come from Europe, or is going to be, you know, what do you think the mix is going to be between APAC and Europe to fund, you know, the projects that are needed in the region?
I think it's very difficult to tell what the mix will be. I mean, what we do sense from investor conversation is that there is interest in investing into Asia. I mean, this has been clearly a long-term trend now, supported by the economic outlook for the region, as Alex said. And many of our investors have done so on the liquid side, in real estate, et cetera, but they haven't found the ways of doing that in renewables. So from our perspective, we foresee a flow of capital from Europe into the region, but also as more and more institutional investors in the region are interested in increasing their exposure to renewable energy and to sustainable investments, we believe that there will also be a very significant participation from investors out of the very region.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, if you wanna, would you like to add anything? Or
like much cross-border investment from regional or local investors in renewables so far? So to date, in the markets that are a bit mature, there's a local domestic investor base that has become familiar with the asset class and is investing, understands the risk returns, and is happy to invest into, for example, utility scale solar power plants. But the cross-border effects are only showing very slowly in the region. So I think this is something where we definitely can play a role to bring investors from certain parts of the regions into markets that are attractive.
Perfect. And then just maybe for my benefit, you know, in terms of, you know, the way that you do in the supply chain and the fact that you kind of source the deals, you finance them, you structure them, and then you actually operate them as well. So you're working cross vertically, right? And on top of that, obviously, you have the whole investment management and the relationship with clients. So is that a common structure, or is that in kind of an Aquila kind of model that you develop? How often do you see these?
I mean, I think you find that there are few businesses that actually have that very strong capability below asset management. Yeah. And we deliberately build it as a way to differentiate. If you were just to invest in operating projects, you will find that there is a lot of competition for that. And so you need to get in front of that. And the only way you can do that is you have your own origination, and you have the capacity to take on projects at earlier stages, de-risk them and bring them into operation. And I think that business model has worked quite well for us, and is appreciated by our clients because it gives that holistic picture on it, the project life.
Perfect. And then if I just touch upon, you know, kind of new ways to you know, structure products or propositions, which I think Alex mentioned in a way, but I wanted to bring the attention to the UK and the Aquila European Renewables Income Fund that I think that what you listed last year, right, in 2018 in the London Stock Exchange. And although it's, you know, in context, again, a small inverted commas, you know, at almost 200 million as of June, did call my attention because, you know, you are pretty much, you know, quite German, Europe, and then, you know, you kind of did the UK listing. What is the idea, and you know, what are you trying to do there, and why do you do it?
Yes, thank you. And the fund has grown by now. We just completed in October a capital increase for 127 million. So market cap wise, we're about 330 now. But to your point about why we did it, I think on a very philosophical level, we wanted to offer investment products to investors who cannot invest easily in renewable energy, because normally our core business are private funds, very long dated, depending on their structure between 12 to 20 years, in the example of our hydro fund. And therefore, you're missing out that spectrum of individual investors, but also professional investors like equity fund managers, multi-asset fund managers, who'd like to get exposure to the underlying income stream from those. And by creating a listed company, you're kind of transforming that liquidity. You're creating that liquidity around a traded stock that helps them to allocate to it. Now, the reason why we chose London as a listing venue was evident from the market that was established there. And when we looked at how many other offerings are there, we realized that there was no offering that actually allowed investors to allocate to continental Europe and Ireland, so all Europe. And hence, that was our idea of bringing a pure play European, balanced European renewable fund into the UK and listing it on the London Stock Exchange.
Fantastic. Again, thank you for doing it, and great. You know, I think that we talked in another call before as well in terms of the other companies, UK-based, that are kind of present in the specific industry. So it is good, you know, as always, to have the possibility or the opportunity to have, you know, European companies. And now, you know, with the global remit and global footprint, I think it's great. And thanks for that. Well, and obviously, at the same time, it's nice to see kind of innovative ways to give access, like you said, and as a lot of people may not know, that are not in the market, do not realize kind of the length of the projects and how long, you know, it takes, you know, and how the commitment, you know, a very large commitments to make them happen as well. So great. If I move to kind of what I call identifying and measuring, you know, the impact that you're having, is there anything that you can share with us in terms of how you are collecting the information and, you know, what type of reports you are using? You mentioned right at the beginning, I think, about ESG, and you do mention in terms of on your website of how the group employs kind of a fully integrated investment and asset management approach, which integrates ESG, you know, throughout the investment process. But is there anything specifically, perhaps, kind of as best practices, you know, that you can share and some of the lessons for people that are just coming behind you and trying to learn?
I mean, from a measurement perspective, of course, one measurement that we can put out there and you already referred to is the amount of renewable energy produced. And eventually, depending on kind of the country in which it is produced, sort of the CO2 emissions avoided by that, because you're crowding out other fossil-based production. Then, of course, you can look, and Alex mentioned it, you can look at the employment and the social aspects that you're creating through the very construction of those projects. Yeah, often those tend to be in more rural areas because you need space to build large-scale generation, and therefore you can also look at what you achieve in that regard. And I think, I mean, if you, and these are measurements that the company can take for its own, but then you can also subject yourself, and we would advocate for that, to an external measurement, and we use GRESB and register our projects there for their assessment. They then basically put it in the context of a peer group and give you feedback so you can also evolve and improve. I think for us, it's the most rewarding if we see how our ratings in GRESB also increase in the consecutive years. So that's our aspiration. And GRESB in itself, being a institution that was founded by institutional investors, is speaking very much to what institutional investors, what our clients are looking for. So we're very comfortable working with an external rating like GRESB.
Sorry, can you just repeat again, the rating that you're using is?
GRESB, Global Real Estate Standards Board, and they have started to apply their ratings not only in the real estate sector, but also now broaden that to infrastructure. And as renewable energy is part of that, they include our project in their ratings.
Fantastic. And then Alex, just a quick one on that for you, as you start developing your plans and your projects, do you look at the impact that you will have with a specific intentionality from the get-go, or do you calculate kind of the impact you have as a byproduct after after the years that you're running the projects?
I would love to say the former, but I think it's the latter. Okay. Because in the end, I think the reality of the markets is that you have to focus on where the opportunities in terms of where the regulatory and policy framework allows you to do business first. But it's definitely a byproduct, and it's something that we definitely account for. And, you know, on a micro level, and I touched on it before, this is more anecdotal than anything else. But if you, for example, are the first mover in a country like the Philippines and you build a 50 megawatt solar project in the middle of nowhere, to see all of a sudden that the local motorbike dealer is sold out because 1,000 people have gotten a job that wasn't existing before. These are the topics that are really, I think, very intangible. You don't put this in a report, obviously, yes. But these are the nice anecdotal and intangible effects, I think, if we're talking about impact on the lives of people in the communities where really renewable energy assets are being developed and built.
It's interesting, right? So it's the kind of the domino effect that obviously, you know, is completely indirect to what you're doing. But thank you for the honesty as well, because still the needs of the people and of the country are still basic fundamentals, which are energy. And then still, as much as people think that we need to lead sometimes, you know, with some of these projects from an impact perspective with intentionality, you know, I do bring to the attention to many people as I talk to investors as well, is that people are still focusing on the fundamentals, which is, you know, the generation of energy in this case, yeah, reduction of CO2 emissions and performance, right?
And we need to remind ourselves why we're doing this. I mean, there is so many countries, so many cities that declared a climate emergency. Yeah. And whilst you were wishing everyone on the program being healthy and we are all consumed by Corona and the immediate impact on our lives, in the background, there is the climate crisis has not abated. I mean, it didn't stop. Mm. It is going on. Yeah. Mm. And I think we have on our board of advisors, we have a very eminent climate scientist, John Schellhuber, and I was particularly inspired when he put up basically the formula for emergency is in his definition, and he published a paper in Nature about this, is that emergency is the product of risk and urgency, right? And risk is probability times magnitude of damage, yeah? Whilst the urgency is your time to react divided by the available intervention time. And we don't have that much time. I mean, if you believe science and if you believe the scientists, then we need to act. And I think we are aiming to contribute to these decarbonization goals through the very projects that we are building on behalf of institutional investors. And I think we see a great motivation by governments in Europe, in particular the European Union, adopting the Green Recovery Plan. We'll see how that translates into climate law next March. But the sheer amount of stimulus they're willing to put behind that is massive. And as that awareness is created, we believe that the impact from that is what counts.
Yeah, excellent. And so if we talk, you know, since we're touching on the future, as we start coming to the last questions, let me bring, I think it was the white paper that you published recently, which was about energy efficiency, the first fuel. Is that right? And I picked up on the quote at the beginning, which says the cleanest energy is that which is not consumed at all. And the only question I have, which is, it is a big question, but, you know, are the Paris climate targets achievable, right? Based on everything that is happening now and everything that we need to do. And I know this is a big question and we can talk just on this maybe for an hour, but perhaps if you can share, you know, your 2 minutes of thoughts about it, and especially Alex as well.
Look, in my view, we have, and science tells us that we have years of change. And I think it depends on the determination. I think now we see a lot of incentive being set in the right way. You see German BMW basically handing climate targets to individual board members in order to their management in order to achieve them. That will make an impact in that organization. And I think that has found other companies that are replicating that. You see corporates coming together under RE100, actually committing to climate goals, and by now RE100 is actually somewhere about 260 companies now, significant companies who are looking to procure power from green sources, and kind of that's where we're connecting to them because we are supplying green power. So I think it's the determination of and about creating an impact as this is relevant. We believe that putting out investment product, investment capabilities will help people to invest in the energy transition because the participation of private capital is absolutely necessary. Yeah. And energy efficiency is a prime example where you don't have a lot of private capital participation at the moment. EU alone wants to spend 90 billion on energy efficiency. And to my knowledge, the amount of investment products is a mere fraction of that. So an ability to bundle investor capital and put it to work for that benefit of reducing primary energy consumption is important. And from my point of view, that's our responsibility as an organization, as an entrepreneurial organization, building investment products for investors that help them to participate in that. So I'm, as a father of three children, I'm reasonably confident that we're still getting there. And one last comment, as we're talking today, overshadowed by the corona crisis, I mean, there's a lot of research going into finding the right vaccination. But I mean, we also need to sponsor research on the climate crisis. And so, for example, that's one of the reasons why we put out a research award to actually help and fund young researchers in their scientific research for methods of reducing the climate impact.
Perfect. Is that the Aquila Capital Transformation Award?
Yeah. Correct.
Perfect. Which is accelerating decarbonization in Europe. Which is interesting. And let me just say one more thing, Alex, before I come to you, which is sometimes we forget. So we're trying to make it more efficient and decarbonize, especially in some of the developed countries and some of the countries that are consuming a lot of, again, inverted commas, bad energy. And at the same time, there are a lot of countries where we are going, like, you know, we are trying to do and setting up from the get-go, good, clean energy. So maybe, Alex, I don't know if you want to add anything in terms of what you think the future holds.
Well, I would want to take one step back to a previous question about the Paris target. And, you know, we're here in Asia, obviously, the challenges are equally high, but from a different direction. Again, looking at how the population growth in this part of the world, the development kind of status of most of these countries, which means especially on the energy generation side, electricity generation side, outdated generation mixes, a lot of coal and gas, a lot of coal still existing. And interestingly enough, Lars mentioned the RE100. The governments in that region have been very reluctant in the past years or so, in the past 5 years, to support renewable energy. Why? First of all, most of the time, state-owned centralized power sector. So incumbents don't want to do new things, want to rather stick to their old cash cows, basically. Mm-hmm. And second, obviously, in the past, renewable energy was expensive. You had to support it in order to create a like-for-like competitive situation. This changes massively. We're coming now to a situation where renewable energy in more and more countries is competitive on a grid parity or on a socket parity basis, which we call if basically the power that you would consume from a solar power plant would be equally expensive on average as the amount that you would pay to your local utility for a kilowatt hour. And this is obviously the breakthrough because reaching this parity means a government can't really resist anymore and the local power sector can't really resist anymore. And this will replace more, I think, again, a government-driven free market, liberalized power market situation where investors like us can compete. Because what is clear is where currently the RE100 groups making big impact here in the region by really, for example, sourcing power from behind the meter power plants on their rooftops, which are not governed by the regulation of the respective power market. In the future, to really get anywhere close to the number that I previously cited, which is these $4,530 billion that are required here in the region in the next 3 decades, this has to come largely from foreign direct investors because local investors will not be able to fund that. So there's a massive chance here, I think, to really push this effort to reach the Paris climate targets.
Great. Yes. And I know that we are not covering yet this with Aquila, but you know, the same applies for Latin America and other parts, you know, which we haven't talked about that, but that's kind of originally where I was born. So I'm always keeping my eye on. I also, when you mention the numbers, it always reminds me, you know, the importance of the amount of, you know, millions of people living on the APAC region, which makes it so, so relevant. But thank you very much both for that. As we start, there was one thing I was going to mention, and maybe it's more like a reflection now rather than extending more and more on the question, but I always ask about how do we scale, how do we transition more capital into sustainable and impact investment. And I hope that by now listeners realize, you know, why I thought that it would be so nice to have you guys in the podcast, because in a way you are showing the way. You know, it has taken you close to 20 years now. You know, you have shown kind of how, you know, from the entrepreneurial part, you can set up, you know, a full-blown supply chain management of an investment house. You have managed to secure and sign deals with kind of Japan, this Japan-based Daiwa, right? Companies, right. So cross-cultural, you know, Germany, Switzerland, APAC. You know, you are creating access to investors kind of at every level, you know, with the kind of UK IPO as an example, you know, setting up new house in Singapore. So I'm answering my own question now, but, you know, maybe if I understood it correctly, as I see it, that's why I thought it was very nice to have you here with us today, is to show, you know, an example, a role model of how, you know, we can transition, you know, capital, as I always call it, transition and scale capital into sustainable investing. And also it's a very great example to show that it takes time. It takes time to be able to build all of these, you know, let alone to run the projects, which, as we talked about before, you know, are going to run into the next 20 plus years. So anything else that you perhaps want to share in terms of what else can be done that hasn't been done yet by you to be able to help transition capital and to get more clients and more investors perhaps to Aquila and to other similar companies?
Look, yes. And I think when we set up new investment teams or in fact new regions, and there's a massive upfront investment by the company into these efforts based on our strategy, based on our beliefs, and based on the feedback that we hear from clients. Of course, as you rightly say, you often start very small because people want to see you demonstrating your capability. And I think in particular on the last roadshow for our list fund, we encountered a number of investors that really like what we do and they like the company, but due to market capitalization, it is too small for them. And I think one argument here is that creating an impact works in many, many ways, and also creating an impact by helping to set up not only our offerings, but also those amongst, I mean, if a broader universe of offerings for the renewable industry exists, everyone benefits. And I think in that respect, having the support of institutional investors is an important facilitator for the growth of that. And we are obviously in a very close dialogue with our investors, but we would invite more to look at this in a way that even new areas need to have supporting capital behind it. And from a innovation point of view, it is obviously our aim to find relevant and sustainable products that help investors creating a long-term impact on renewable energy.
Great. Thank you, Lars. Alex, any thoughts on that?
Nothing much to add. I think this was okay. Very comprehensive. The only point really that in this region here, for example, until 2-3 years ago, all the capital that was rooted into renewables was basically coming from private equity players with the respective return expectations. And obviously, more institutions going into the asset class also here in the region helps significantly to boost the sector here.
Perfect. And we don't want to really cover or touch too much on performance, but is it still kind of a ballpark or high level? Is it still reasonable to expect private equity type returns, or do we need to adjust them, you know, to be able to grow more?
I think, I mean, we don't want to touch upon particular performance in the program, but I think it's again a question of risk and return and where you want to position yourself in that spectrum. Of course, development risks offer different returns than, for example, operating assets. different countries and or different region offer different returns. And that's kind of where we are structuring our offering in a way that we can reach investors with these specific requirements.
Yes. So as we're coming towards the end now, I just didn't want to go away without asking you just maybe one kind of more personal question, which is around, again, what is it that has inspired you to do what you're doing and to get into this business and in this sector in particular? In the case of Lars, I think it's very nice. I said this to him in private, which is to see the evolution from his roles, you know, in some of these major companies such as BlackRock and UBS, and the type of roles that he has done to then not become this individual developing this fantastic business. And again, I must admit, Lars today, I think I caught him on a very kind of Thursday morning energy, but he's extremely, extremely passionate about what he does. And some of the calls we have had, you know, he has kind of filled me with energy when he talked to me about the business and everything that they're doing. Maybe again, and then Alex, you know, fantastic, you know, specialized career, you know, with that consulting background. We haven't even talked too much about all the leadership roles that he had had and the changes that he created, transformations, you know, across every level of the organizations, you know, his passion for diversity and communication, you know, within the firms to be able to manage them properly. So on all of that, you know, anything in particular that, you know, kind of drives you and made you do these, that inspires you? You mentioned Lars, one of the board members before, and something that, you know, caught your attention, but during your career, is there anything in particular that you want to share with the listeners that perhaps, you know, they can check or be inspired as well?
Look, I mean, you said an evolution, and I think that's right, from sort of public markets to private markets, and within that to renewable energy and the wider energy transition. I think from my perspective, I've done 20 years of, I mean, all my life in asset management, and I think it's an industry, I mean, has extreme relevance because it helps to service the ultimate beneficiaries are pensioners and people who entrust their money to someone else to help them to achieve better outcomes for their life. And it has purpose. So I think, I mean, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. And I think the work here adds this real asset component to it. There's tangible projects that we built. And of course, we're making a positive contribution to the overall targets of society in decarbonizing. So I think that is my prime motivation.
Great. And Alex, what has it been, you know, your career and especially as well, you know, moving from Europe to APAC?
As you mentioned, JP, I took a little detour until I ended up where I am now because I started consulting. I think as much as I liked it and as much as it was a brilliant school to do this for a couple of years, especially with a focus on restructuring, what was missing in the end was kind of what drives you to do that? What's the purpose? And when I moved across into the renewables industry, which at that time was super, super immature, it was 13 years ago, I think I was looking for something that really captures me. And maybe coming from a different direction than Lars, who's always been on the investment side of things, I enjoy building multidisciplinary teams and kind of manage them and lead them to become really high performance teams. And if you are in the industry we are in with the impact that Lars just described, for me, it's always really very, very rewarding if you stand in front of such an asset and the meter starts ticking, because it's tangible. It's really tangible. It's not a financial product. It's something where you root investments into, but you develop it, you see it being built, and you see the actual product standing there. And if you have ever seen a 50 or 100 megawatt solar park, it's massive in terms of scale. And once you flip the switch and really clean energy is being produced, that's a very rewarding feeling.
And any specific advice for kind of other CEOs with less experience or a younger Alex? We do get a lot of kind of younger professionals, you know, asking all sorts of questions about how to transition and, you know, what to do, etc. But obviously, there are a lot of, you know, CEOs that have less experience than you. So I thought I'll ask you that specifically.
Well, I'd say if you want to be anywhere in the renewable sector, it's still an immature sector and it's still a very volatile sector. You need to stay curious. You need to stay agile, even if this word is a bit overstressed nowadays. But you need to stay on your toes, really, because not one year is like the other. Things are constantly changing in the marketplace and you need to embrace and like change. I think this is something which I find very important for my career.
Very good. And as a leader, what do you think makes an impact leader? How would you define it also through your experiences and other people that you have seen?
Well, it probably depends on which level you define the impact. For the entire business, I always think the leader has the biggest impact on the team, like choosing the right people, giving them the right direction, giving them the freedom to do what they're good at and let them thrive. It's very simple, maybe a bit too general, but this is how I see it.
No, that's excellent. That's excellent. It's picking the right people and leading. And before that, staying curious. I think those are the three things I picked up. And Lars, anything would you like to say from your part?
We are people's business. Asset investment management is driven by the intellectual capital of the people working within our company. So as Alex said, selecting the right people, empowering them and supporting them is, in my view, critical. As the asset management industry has significantly evolved over time, I think staying ahead is important. Standing still is not an option. And also for us is endorsing new areas. Yeah, as a lot of innovation will come down our way. I mean, we're starting to look into green hydrogen. We're looking into storage. We're looking into a lot of applications that will develop over time. You need to, Alex's point, stay intellectually curious. You have to have the ambition to analyze these aspects and come and create sound investment decisions from them.
Fantastic. And any last call to action, and how can people get in touch with you?
First name, not last name, at aquila-capital.com. It's really fascinating having that dialogue with you. And as you said, we're speaking for Alex here. We're both passionate about what we do. And if there are any questions that people on the listeners to the program have and want us to ask, get in touch directly. We're a very approachable business, and I'd like to help and like to exchange views if that's of interest.
Fantastic. And Alex?
Yes, I'm happy to second that. Next to this very cryptic email that Lars just gave, we can also be found via LinkedIn, I'd say. So happy to be in touch with anyone who's interested to learn more or enter into a dialogue.
Fantastic. And just in case, everyone will see all the notes as well, but I did make a mistake with your spelling, and it's L-E-N-Z, which is Alexander Lenz, so that people get the right person. Lars is L-A-R-S, Meisinger, which is M-E-I-S-I-N-G-E-R. Perfect. Right. Thank you so much for your time, both of you. I truly wish you, all the success. Very well done to Aquila and the founders and the partners for everything that you have done today. And Alex, I'm so excited for you. It's a really, like I say, among all the challenges, that we are facing, it is truly a world of opportunities. And I'm always an optimist, and I think that, we have great things ahead of us. So thank you, guys.
Thank you very much for having us. Thank you.
So it is bye for now, and until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Please remember to check our sponsors' websites for upcoming events. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILM Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILM Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.